This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, your pop culture home.
Yeah, Frank here has got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's what do you call it, Kramer?
Billiard room.
No, not billiard, not the billiards, it was...
Billiards room.
Come on already. Come on, we call it the...
The Place to Be.
The Place to Be, yes, the Place to Be.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can.
Time to play the game!
Well, you always left me satisfied and smiling, so...
That's what she said!
Why do I want this? I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Place to Be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be Podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
D'Lo Brown interfered with a frog splash and hit it on Severin, getting some revenge.
I know.
What the hell was it? What was that laugh? It was like an old cartoon fucking Hanna-Barbera dog or something. It was like Snidely? Was that the fucking dog that laughed like that?
JR's got a little more time than I do to sit and actually rewrite a whole show.
This is the third time you said it to me today now. I'm really curious.
Well, I'm not saying that you have nothing to do. I'm just saying your
curious
day...
How, I'm curious how I have more free time than
no,
you.
No, I'm gonna...
What does that mean?
I don't know.
I know it's been a rough, and I'm not used to this long, grueling podcast yet.
Oh, for fuck's sakes. Are you guys just joking off for the next hour?
Come on. Did you say D'Amato, late 20s, 30s?
I was being...
And you included yourself in that as well?
I was being nice to him. I am still technically in my 30s.
I think they might hit a shock wall.
What the fuck is a shock wall?
Is that the Shockmaster's wall?
He's going to fall through the shock wall.
Yeah, I like Big Dick myself. PTB Nation. Let me know what you're
our opener.
To do worse than Josh Richard.
Place to Be Nation. Welcome back to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be Podcast. I'm your co-host, Justin Rosero, and we have a mega, super big episode of the PTB Podcast for you here tonight. It's the interview you thought maybe you'd never hear here on PTB Nation. Before we get to that, let's set things up for you. Let me bring in my PIC, the one and only Scott Criscola. Scott, how you doing?
Good evening, JR. Always good to talk to you. And good evening, PTB Nation. Welcome to episode 247 of the Place to Be Podcast. And I got to tell you something. I'm hitting the nail. You're hitting the nail right on the head. I'm seconding hitting the nail on the head because you're right. The guest you never thought you'd hear is right here inside Place to Be Nation. And it's an honor, believe it or not. Some people a long time ago may have thought not, but I disagree. We got him tonight. And we'll get to him in a moment. First, however, we got a few topics to discuss. JR, I'll let you lead off. Go ahead.
All right. Well, we just want to quickly catch everyone up on placetobenation.com. A lot of stuff going on. Some big things have kicked off here recently in the last couple days. We had a cool piece up yesterday. RJ Brewer, also known as John Walters, you've heard him here on the program before, competes for Lucha Libre USA. He did a piece on steroids and sports that he posted for us here on placetobenation.com, kind of an exclusive thing. So if you want to check that out, it's pretty good. Also, a very big interview. If you listen to the show regularly, you would have heard Greg Phillips last week talk about this interview he had, him and Nick Duke, and it's up today with the author of the Headlocked Wrestling comic book. Mm-hmm. This is something they were really excited about. It's a very in-depth interview with the author of that. And if you want to check that out, it's right up there at the top right now. And then if you don't get to it today, it'll definitely be on the front page for a little bit. And eventually you can just search under the comics tab if you need to find it. That's Mike Kingston is the author of that book. So check
yes.
that out. Divas, watching Total Divas. We have the fourth week in the book. Jen Engel and Ben Morse do a great job recapping that with a kind of a unique slant than just the normal TV recap. We also have our college football previews kicked off. We have yourself and Chad and Brad and Todd Gessling mm-hmm. debut today doing the Pac-12 North. We're breaking down all the conferences plus some other kind of newsworthy things to look for and other big games coming up. NFL season preview underway as well. Day 6 is up today, so you go back, look at the first 12 teams. We're doing two teams a day right up until the season kicks off. We'll also have our predictions. We're going to do power rankings every week, predictions every week. A lot going on with football, of course. All the podcasts you like are up. The Kings of Sport had a very interesting interview with Russell Hollywood Simpson, of course, was the former boyfriend of former NFL safety Kerry Rhodes. And, you know, he had some things to say about that and his relationship with Rhodes and other things going on in the NFL and the world of entertainment. Weber Has Issues, always great as well. That's our regular column. Richard and the Mailman. It's at three episodes in. They recap every week of Breaking Bad, and they're going to start expanding to the newsroom and some other topics as well. Very entertaining show. It's only about an hour or two, so not much time commitment there if you want to check that out. Of course, Scott's Raw Recap, Where the Big Boys Play, have an episode up. Jim Crockett Promotions, the Good Old Days DVD review. Return of the Hack was up this week, looking at instant replay in baseball, plus some other news and notes from the last couple weeks in the sport. So tons of stuff for you on placetobenation.com. Rolling out each and every day, whether you like sports, wrestling, TV, movies. We're going to have music soon. We have it all. Comics is big, too. If you're a comics fan, there's no reason you should not be checking the site out every day, because we got something for you pretty much almost every day.
Yes.
Jeremy Nichols, reviewing horror movies, all kinds of things on there. The Titans of Wrestling podcast, which is Parv and James, and they look at the WWF from 1979 to 1983. It's kind of a lost period. So a lot of cool stuff. If you want to check that out, please, placetobenation.com. Everything you need in the world of pop culture. You can also, if you're interested in writing for the site, if you always wanted to give it a shot to write something, just hit us up at info@placetobenation.com. We're looking for podcasts, writers, videos, anything you have. We'll run it through the crew and see if we want to add you to the site. And we'll accept most people as long as it's high quality. So definitely give it a whirl. You never know. A great piece coming tomorrow, or I guess maybe today by the time you're hearing this, that I really want to push, and that's Katie Price's life story. She's a writer here on the site. It's a very, very interesting, unique story. She's been through a lot of tough things in her life, and it's inspirational. So if you're going through some tough times, Katie has a story that'll just make you stop and think and realize maybe it's not so bad, and maybe it is so bad. And if it is, you're not alone. You know, she's someone that has a lot of good words and interesting stories. So if you're into those kind of things, just check tomorrow, placetobenation.com, Katie Price's My Life. So we'll leave that there. But again, if you have any questions, you can find us at facebook.com/placetobenation. You can find us at Twitter @placetobenation, or also all our email addresses are on the site. We're all very accessible. We always respond to everyone's emails or posts on Facebook or tweets. We'll get back to you. So also, we're still working on getting Kevin Kelly to do the first half of 2000. Just waiting to shore something up. Again, we had recorded that last week. It had an issue with the files. The file lost. So we're going to have to re-record that for you. So that's pretty much all the news and notes. Scott, I know you had a couple things you wanted to hit before we get to our guest.
Yes, two things. Number one, I think a congratulations needs to go out to one Ichiro Suzuki for reaching 4,000 hits. He got that tonight in your building, JR, against the Blue Jays. And, of course, the debate will begin on whether this is 4,000 legitimate hits, which is a bunch of crap. But congrats to him. 1,278 hits in Japan, 2,700, and as of this now, 222 hits in the U.S. So he's close to 3,000 hits and 257 hits away from Pete Rose's record. And I think my opinion is if Major League Baseball can do it, they would hope he gets a record, and then they could just wipe Pete Rose from everybody's memory. But who knows? But anyway, congrats to Ichiro for a milestone in his career and in baseball tonight.
All right, Scott, we're going to save your other big announcement for next episode. How about that?
Yes, yes. Because that could go on for a while.
Yes, and our guest is here, and we don't want to keep him waiting any longer. The one and only, the man behind RSPWFAQ.com, the great Scott Keith. Scott, welcome here tonight to Place to Be Nation.
Hey, thanks. I'm glad to be here tonight, actually.
All right. We are very happy to have you. This has been, you know, way too long in the making. We've been doing the show for 2.5 years, and we've been wanting to have you on for that entire time, and I'm glad we finally were able to work out a schedule. And again, that's rspwfaq.com, and Scott has a great blog, a great site over there with all kinds of cool wrestling and non-wrestling related stuff, but we'll get to that later, Scott. We wanted to go way back. Tell us how you first got into the sport of wrestling. Who were your favorites early on? Kind of tell us where you grew up and maybe regionally who you liked. Just a little bit of your background as a wrestling fan.
Sure. Well, actually, I grew up in a town outside of Vancouver, British Columbia, in Canada. So mostly, I wasn't actually interested in wrestling. I was like a little kid, but my dad was always a big fan of Al Tomko's All-Star Wrestling in Vancouver and Stampede Wrestling out of Calgary, obviously. So he watched a lot of it, and I just kind of, you know, picked it up by osmosis for the most part. My first active exposure to it would have been around 1986. My mom rented WrestleMania 2 for my birthday party for reasons I'm still not sure about. And I never liked the Hulk Hogan guy. He always rubbed me the wrong way. And so after I watched that, you know, my dad would be watching, you know, like Superstars on TV or something like that. And I'd be like, oh, hey, I know that guy. I saw him on that video. And then it's like, why is he being such a jerk to Paul Orndorff? You're not calling him back or nothing. And then Orndorff turned on him, and I was like, yes, this is what I'm watching now forever.
There you go.
So, yeah, so kind of hooked me on there like that. And then, you know, of course, Randy Savage went and dropped a ring bell on Ricky Steamboat's throat. And I was like, okay, you can take all my money for the next 30 years now.
Is there anything else regionally where you were besides WWF at the time, or what led you eventually to watching anything outside of that?
Well, yeah, actually, my dad would watch, you know, there's the regional stuff that was on there, this All-Star Wrestling out of Vancouver, featuring such stars as the Atomic Kid and the Frog. And of course, Stampede Wrestling is available most places in Canada up here on TSN, so there's a lot of exposure to that. And, you know, of course, my favorites there were, you know, guys like Owen Hart and Chris Benoit early on in his career. The Tomko's All-Star Wrestling was certainly nothing special, to say the least, but that's actually where Mauro Ranallo got his start back in the early 80s as a heel commentator, of all things, which I had an opportunity to remind him about when I was on a radio show with him a couple of years ago, too. He was kind of amused that I actually remembered that portion of his career.
We were talking last week. We had a big SummerSlam roundtable, obviously, with SummerSlam this past week going on. One of the questions we were asking everyone was your memories of the first SummerSlam and kind of the impact of the show. Did you immediately feel like it was a big-time event? Or if not, what was the first SummerSlam that really kind of took over and captured your imagination as, okay, this is almost like a WrestleMania now?
Well, I mean, up here in the frozen wastelands of Canada, we actually did not even get pay-per-view until 1992. So SummerSlam 92 was the first one I actually had the opportunity to see on anything other than like renting the videotape months after the fact. Like the original SummerSlam, I don't know, I you know, because at the time there was only the one pay-per-view, basically. It was WrestleMania, and then, you know, Survivor Series was kind of a new thing, right? So SummerSlam seemed more like a, you know, really important Saturday night's main event at the time. Didn't really register as a huge event. And that, aside from the fact that Ultimate Warrior kicking the crap out of Honky Tonk Man is one of my all-time favorite memories as a wrestling fan. But, I mean, yeah, I'd say, I think 92 was like, because, you know, just for me personally, that was the very first wrestling pay-per-view I was actually able to order. So, I mean, that, you know, that registers big on my memories as a fan. And, you know, of course, it was, you know, 85,000 people or whatever it was in the stadium. So that was the first SummerSlam as well, where it was kind of portrayed as an actual big-time WrestleMania-type event.
Now, what was it like when you were a kid obtaining tapes? Like, was there a video store? Obviously, there are video stores close to you. What was the quickness with which tapes and pay-per-views in particular, you mentioned that you weren't able to order them until 92. How quick were the tapes getting to your store for you to rent? Was it a slow process up there?
It was a pretty slow process, yeah. It's like 4 or 5 months delayed from when the show was on.
Wow.
And, yeah, so... It's, you know, and of course there wasn't the internet back then for tape trading, so I was kind of a videotape scavenger as far as, you know, I'd always hit all the you know, libraries and videotape rental places in the area, constantly looking for, you know, this, the kind of the gold mine was always the, you know, the big bins of previously viewed videos that they had there all the time. You can get some like awesome stuff for really cheap that you could never find anywhere else. Like I have tons of original Coliseum videos, for instance, that I picked up for a couple of bucks from there, because, you know, once people have watched them a few times and they're not junkies like us, you know, they're naturally not going to want to hang on to them like that. So that had proved to be kind of a treasure trove for me. I was always really good finds there. But mostly I would just kind of, you know, go from from store to store, bugging my parents to let me rent, you know, WrestleManias over and over again until I came up with the idea of having two VCRs and being able to dub one to the other.
Those are the greatest times ever when you realize that back in the day.
That was a great moment in my life when I figured out that was actually possible, yeah.
My cousin was doing that stuff like back in 1990, and he would just come over with copies of things for me, and I'm like, it was like magic to me. I'm like, I had no idea how I get this copy of Survivor Series 89. I don't know how it happened, but here it is in front of me. So tell us, you know, obviously we go through the early 90s, and you're obviously still becoming, you know, or still are a huge fan. As we transitioned, Hogan leaves, and obviously you're probably excited about that, and Bret Hart starts to rise up, and Shawn Michaels. And at what point did you really get into the internet wrestling scene? Was it early on? I mean, we've seen some guys, you know, like CRZ, who we're going to talk to next Wednesday. He was up and at it like in 93, 94, 92, actually, I think, as far back as stuff, posting online, and Herb Coons as well. And so when did you kind of get the bug to get online and start reading stuff and then get the urge to start writing about it?
Yeah, well, I was early on too. Actually, I started when I was starting university in late '92 was when I was basically in computing science, in theory working towards a degree, but basically just screwing around playing games in the lab for the most part. And they had this, you know, it was the hardcore Unix machines, right? Like, you know, the direct connection to the internet way back in the day there, and that was actually before, you know, the World Wide Web and everything like that. So you would place you go for discussions would be the news groups, and just on a whim, I typed in wrestling into the news group reader because I was bored in the lab as usual, and lo and behold, there was RSPW for the first time, and it was a mind-blowing experience, to say the least. You know, considering that most of my exposure to other things in the wrestling world had come from, you know, like the After magazines, like Pro Wrestling Illustrated and that kind of thing, which I'd been a subscriber to for many years at that point. It was hearing just the change in terminology alone, right? The first time that somebody had talked about, you know, like a heel turn or baby face turn or an angle or juice, and, you know, just it was like in 2001 where he's, you know, traveling through the vortex and his mind is exploding all over the screen. It was just it was an amazing experience for me, because it was like there's this whole vocabulary that I didn't know existed, but it suddenly made everything made sense for me now. So from the first review I ever wrote then was WrestleMania 9, and it was terrible.
Oh.
And yeah.
That's so right, that's right, the show was too.
Yeah, the show was terrible. The review was not great either. I just kind of, you know, continued on from there on the news group, doing my reviews there, and that took up about the next 6 years of my life, just going from that place. And then I went .com in 1999 and never looked back.
What were some of the earliest news stories you remember being broken at that time? It always fascinates me. Those who were online back in the early 90s, because I didn't really get on until about early 96. like 94, 95, I had the Journal line, which was the Providence Journal's sports line, and they had some guy who basically, I think, was just reading reading the newsletter from Dave Meltzer. So, but what were like the kind of the first news stories? Were there any that broke that you kind of bit on? I remember one that was big in like May of 96 was Yokozuna is going to come back and beat Shawn Michaels for the title. Like just stuff like that. Was there any kind of crazy shit going on back then that you kind of bought and were looking for?
Oh, yeah. There was like the stuff all over the place. I was actually one of the ones I was instrumental in starting was Undertaker changing his name to Savior and coming back in a white costume as an angelic figure, in fact.
I remember that, yeah.
Like, yeah, it's just like great, crazy stuff like that would come all over the place. And, you know, none of it ever came true, really, but it was, you know, it was Wild West, basically, at that time when, as far as the online rumors and everything went. The biggest one at that point was probably Lex Luger blabbing about his world title win to a reporter in a bar before WrestleMania 10. I remember that one gained a lot of traction, and well, there turned out to be complete bullshit later on, of course. But, you know, at the time, what did we know, right?
Yeah.
Now, I, you know, from a lot of your writings and rants, you're a big Ric Flair fan. So when did you get into NWA, WCW? Was it ever a threat to you as far as WWF, or did you just enjoy both the whole time? And what was your thoughts when Flair jumped to the WWF?
There was actually one of the highlights of my viewing nights as a wrestling fan. It was actually a five-hour block of wrestling that was on one of the local stations out of Seattle or Spokane, Washington. I can't remember which one it was. But it was, you get, you know, superstars, worldwide wrestling from NWA and GLOW and POW and Pro Wrestling This Week. So it was pretty awesome set. So I was all over NWA, and actually the kids at school, back when kids at school were talking about wrestling and didn't get beat up over it, they were much more deeply into NWA than WWF. So if you were conversant in both, it was good. The thing is, though, I didn't become a Ric Flair fan until well after I got smartened up as a fan, because I mean, obviously, I just basically hated his guts for the most part, because I was as a wrestling fan before I got online. I was a fan of, you know, Sting and Lex Luger and those kind of guys, and Flair was this, you know, annoying jerk who would cheat and beat them and make me mad, and actually wasn't. Well, it really wasn't until the early 90s that I started to appreciate Flair for, you know, what he would do in the ring as opposed to his character. But, I don't know, when he jumped, I still wasn't online yet, so I didn't really know any of the kind of backstage machinations behind it, right? I just kind of heard that he had gotten fired. And I guess the same thought that all my friends had was, you know, well, he's going to come in and he's going to fight Hogan and it's going to be awesome. And of course, that never really came about until 94, when he went back to WCW. And that was actually a pretty big one as far as big stories breaking online. Since you're having to go with that, we can drift back to that one very briefly, because that was like the apocalypse on online when that one happened. Because, you know, Hogan in WCW was like a, you know, like heresy, right? Like, just the idea of him coming in and holding that belt is ridiculous. And of course, you know, now, considering what a joke it became later, it's like, you know, who cares, really? But at the time, that was a lot of people were really up in arms about that.
Mentioning Hogan Flair, do you still think, looking back at WrestleMania 8, that they missed out on a huge money match, or do you think that the trade-off we got with the Flair-Savage stuff was worth it?
It was a pretty good trade-off, but I mean, it was just such a no-brainer that they should have had Hogan and Flair at some point on pay-per-view, especially in that thing when, you know, Flair was basically at his peak as a wrestler and a personality, and Hogan was just approaching the end of his peak. And it's like, I know Hoshos did kind of disappointing business and, you know, everything like that, but I mean, you know, how could you not have Flair against Hogan at WrestleMania, especially when they threw them on Bash of the Beach 2 years later and did a buy rate bigger than what WrestleMania did that year.
What about some of the other promotions, Scott, that you, as you mentioned, actually the first show I ever saw in an arena was WrestleMania 2, is what I saw at a closed circuit. What about some of like the tail end of AWA or World Class, Memphis? Did any of that stuff trickle up to your neck of the woods at all in the late 80s?
Yeah, absolutely. We got AWA on... the show on TSN. I think it was the ESPN show that they were,
right,
doing, you know, down at the tail end. So yeah, I used to watch that. We got one of those in the late the early 90s. We got one of the big ugly C-band satellite dishes in our backyard.
Nice.
So that was a godsend as far as following wrestling goes, because we got everything, man, and you could just stick that sucker up there, and it was all kinds of crazy shit that was.
That's awesome.
That was out there. Yeah. So at that point, then, you know, we got the tail end of World Class. I pick up USWA, Smoky Mountain when that started up, BCW. You know, the whole nine yards that was out there floating around in the atmosphere. It was great. And then we had to move and give up the satellite dish. And it was a very sad day in my life.
Oh, so that must have been brutal going from that endless cornucopia to back to just whatever was on standard. What was the first live show you went to?
Would have been a WWF host show in Vancouver in 1986. Hulk Hogan against King Kong Bundy, actually. I don't remember. Yeah, and I think I'm crazy. I seem to recall them doing the finish where Bundy splashed him and got the three count, but then he wanted the five count, and Hogan kicked out at four, and made the comeback, but it's been so long. I can't remember if I'm remembering that one correctly. But
That happened at a house show I went to too. So definitely the case. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the first one, and then they came on a pretty regular basis at that point. I got a lot of good stuff there. I got it was like a six man elimination with Randy Savage's team against Ricky Steamboat's team. I remember being a really awesome match too around that time. So yeah, there was some really good stuff there, and then they kind of came on a regular basis until about the early 90s when business started dying, and then it was a long time. The one thing I do regret is that I never did get to see Ric Flair live. So because it just never. By the time he got there, into WWF, business was on the way down, and they weren't really touring up in Canada and my neck of the woods anymore. And then he went back to WCW, and they never came to Canada. So it was kind of unfortunately I missed out on that one.
What about like Japan and some like international stuff? Like, was it a tape thing? Like, how did you get your first taste of like real international stuff?
That was actually one of it was through Herb Koons. Actually, he was the first guy I started getting tapes from on a regular basis. I had ordered some NWA stuff that I hadn't seen before off of him, and he started recommending Japan stuff for me. He was actually in Edmonton for a Math Nerd conference. In the early 90s, and invited me over with a big stack of tapes, and we were watching a bunch of All Japan Women stuff, and I got my first exposure to guys like Misawa and Kobashi. Although actually there was a few of them that had passed through Stampede, and I didn't even realize that's who it was. Like Hiroshi Hase went through there, and Misawa and a couple other guys had actually been through Stampede Wrestling under totally different names, and I watched them. I'm like, oh yeah, this is I know these guys, and it's kind of an interesting experience that way. But yeah, then once I had my tape trading fix, and I could use the stuff I got from him and trade it off to other guys, and I ended up making a million copies of the Best of the Super Junior tournaments for people, because that was always a really popular one that people were after. So I had the full run of those from about 93 to 96. And all the stuff in there, and then Michinoku Pro I got into after that from their appearances in ECW in the 90s as well. So I ended up accumulating a bunch of hours and hours and hours of that stuff. Everything from them was awesome. I could just sit and watch them for 6 or 8 hours at a time. Before I had a family and a wife and a job and all that fun stuff that sucks up your life now. But yeah, just kind of now, of course, it's much easier to just go on to the various digital download sites, whether legally or not, and pick up hours and hours of Japan. But it was much more of an adventure back in those days.
So have you heard anything from Herb, or do you have any idea what happened? He just kind of vanished once. I know he got really discouraged with wrestling in the late 90s and early 2000s. He wasn't a fan of the Attitude kind of stuff. But does he ever pop up anywhere that you've seen?
No, I have his email address, and I was trying to make contact with him because people on my blog keep bugging me about it. But he never emailed me back, so I don't know what his deal is exactly. I mean, I know he's still a math professor in Ontario, and his students seem to like him, so he's still out there, and he's still doing his thing. But I'm 99% sure he doesn't watch wrestling anymore, because he was basically driven to the brink of insanity by the Attitude Era.
Yes, he was. I love going back. There are some boring days at work. Sometimes I'll pull up the old tidbits. There's an archive out there with all his stuff, and you can slowly see him driving into madness as the 90s went along and hit 98 and 99. And he was
those 2 minute Vince Russo shows were just killing the poor guy. Like he just couldn't take it anymore.
Yes, he definitely was. He was clinging to anything he could, but he finally, I think, threw in the towel. So as we move into that era, 97, 98, 99, you got hooked up with WrestleLine. How did you get in contact with them? You started with Thunder and doing some pay-per-view stuff. Tell us about the evolution of that site and just kind of your work with them.
Yeah, I was basically invited by Mike Samuda and Rick Skaya. I knew Rick through RSPW, and it was originally the WrestleManiacs site. They had joined up. Rick's site had joined up with Mike's site. And so, yeah, they invited me on there to to do Thunder because I was doing Thunder reviews on RSPW and gaining kind of a cult following for that. So I was doing a little bit on there, and then that site got bought up by CBS Sportsline, and I made no money off that, I should point out. And I got a much bigger exposure to the kind of online audience there. I think CRZ ended up quitting doing Raw, and I took over Raw near the end there,
mm-hmm.
and kind of stuck with that for many years afterwards too. And then they basically just folded out of nowhere and didn't tell any of the employees there until the last minute. So, Davey Burkholder, who was the editor at the time, just emailed me one day and he's like, "Yep, it's over. See ya." So easy come, easy go, I guess.
Did you have any of the problems with, like, if you go back and read it, you know, we'll read CRZ stuff to kind of prep for our reviews here. He always seemed to be in beef with someone at WrestleLine, whether it was due to, you know, editing his content or some of the stuff he'd say. Did you have problems like that with them? Was it kind of weird being part of, like, corporate CBS?
Yeah, they were really on me to tone it down a lot. I had to edit most of the swearing that was in there, and then there was other issues that I was having with the whole... I don't know if it's old news, like too old news or not by this point, like the whole issues I was having with the NetCop trademarks and that kind of thing. CBS basically did not stand behind me at all. In fact, threw me under the bus would be a much more accurate description of the situation when everything went down. So yeah, it was good as far as exposure goes, but I mean, as far as a positive experience, no, definitely not. I had much better luck on my own, I think.
Right, so from there, now Ransylvania, did that come right after WrestleLine, or was that kind of simultaneous? Because that's where I first discovered you.
Yeah, it was kind of simultaneous to it. I had a GeoCities site where I was archiving all my reviews and that kind of thing from RSPW, and Sean Shannon basically approached me and said, you know, this site looks terrible. You should do, you know, a more professional site and go .com and everything like that. And As is always my motivation with things like that, I was like, okay, well, sure. If you want to do the work for me, then I'd be happy to do whatever you want. And so that's what happened. He agreed to, you know, do the legwork for me and set everything up as webmaster and all that. So we were off there, and I started putting out a team of people called the Rant Crew, where again, my motivation being that I didn't want to do any of the work, so I would recruit other people to do most of the writing for me, as far as that goes, and. Ended up discovering a couple of people. Justin Shapiro actually got his start doing that, so that ended up being pretty cool later on. And then we, Sean Shannon, of course, then went completely insane and abandoned me, hijacked the site, and we had to relaunch as thesparks.com.
That's right. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with a different webmaster, and actually that was the same day that my apartment burned down. So let me tell you, it was a fantastic day in my
life. Oh, wow!
When I was having the conversation with Sean before he went insane, yeah, and I was like, oh, hang on a second, I gotta check on something. The smoke alarm's going off. And I went outside, and yeah, my apartment was on fire and actually burned down. So I don't know if that was a message from karma or what the deal was there exactly, but that was a fantastic day. So yeah, we launched that site, and it was good and bad because that was during most of the we launched the site during the .com explosion when, you know, revenues were really good, and then revenues completely died off right at the end of it, and the server ended up being a lot of money to deal with, and its traffic got too heavy for the server that we were using, and then. Finally, I decided to shut it down and rate for 411 instead. Mm-hmm. It's much easier than everybody.
Right, instead of trying to run it. Well, I thank you for Ransylvania days because you got me and the future known as now RJ Brewer, John Walters, through a lot of computer classes in college. So we appreciate that. We spent many days on Wrestle Crap and Ransylvania. So.
Hey, yeah, no problem.
When did the connection start with Inside Pulse or 411? When did that get? How did that work out?
Well, yeah, like I say, I started right in 2001. I was just ready to shut down the site. So basically, we absorbed it into 411 because I had, after WrestleLine shut down, I started doing Raw and SmackDown for 411, and then I would kind of do my own thing on the side with you know, Ransylvania and the Sparks. And when it was got to be too much work to run my own sites, then I just got them to bring on all the writers to 411 and kind of run it as a little subsection, and then I just kind of just did everything with 411. Hung around there until about 2006 when Widrow and Ashish, the two people who were running the site, had kind of a falling out. So Widrow split off, and he was the one who brought me onto the site, and I've always been very loyal to him. So where he went, I went, and I went with him to form Inside Pulse in 2006, and been there for about 7 years now, I guess.
So I kind of look at this in two sections, both of your career and wrestling. So I think up to 01 and then kind of 02, 03 when you split off, and that's when the business kind of changed. Obviously, everything went out of business, and we had the monopoly begin. But of those first kind of section up until 01, what's your favorite year to go back and discuss and watch? And what do you think was the best year of that stretch, from when you started watching wrestling until that end of 01 there?
I really, really liked the Monday Night Wars period. I think it was 97, 98 thing was something where we didn't fully appreciate what we had until it was gone. Especially as like my roommate and I were, you know, in 97 were, you know, huge fans, and Monday Night Raw was appointment viewing at that point. We didn't get Nitro, so we only got half the thing, which I really do regret. I really wish we had gotten Nitro in Canada live at that time, because it was like we kind of missed out on that experience that a lot of people seem to have of you know, oh, flipping over what's on Nitro, what's on Raw, and all that, and we only got half of that. But I mean, like there was some awesome stuff on Raw at that point. It was so great to be a fan at that time, like Rick Rude coming out as the bodyguard for DX, and or you know, DX's first appearance in the first place, and you know, the rise of Steve Austin, and like the Mike Tyson episode of Raw, the moment he came out for the brawl with Steve Austin. It was like, this had never been seen before on TV.
Right.
Like, you know, a celebrity doesn't come out and get into a giant brawling match with Vince McMahon, who is revealed as the owner of the company for the first time. And you know, like I say, it really was the Wild West at that point, and it's like just made you so excited to be a wrestling fan. And there's been really very little since then that has really made me excited to be a fan anymore. Ever since the Monopoly era came on.
What was the U.S. Canada stuff like up on your end up there? Was it as big a deal as this came across as a TV? Was there were you guys, you know, you and your friends all into Bret Hart and the Hart Foundation against Austin, or were you just kind of enjoying it for what it was?
Oh no, we were all very much for the Hart Foundation. It was because this was stuff that nobody had said before about, you know, as Canadians, nobody had gone on TV before and said the things that Bret Hart had said, right? Like this was like a new opinion being expressed. Like it wasn't one that you usually heard where somebody came out and said, you know, American healthcare is terrible and they're a bunch of gun nuts and things like that. Like as far as the WWF goes, you only ever got the US viewpoint on things. And, you know, to have Bret come out and say those things, and, you know, he really, like, I know it gets, people in the US don't really appreciate it at the time, but I mean, like, Bret Hart was a Canadian hero. Like as far as his perception of the country, like he would get mobbed at airports at that time, and people really did take this that role that he was playing super seriously, which is probably why Montreal ended up being such a big deal up here.
That's what I was going to say. Take us through that time period as well. I know it's been beaten to death, but we can just do a few minutes on it. Just experiencing that time period in the moment, Bret leaving. I mean, at what point were you aware? I know I had read some rumblings online. Like, I was still kind of new online at that point, so I didn't know what to believe. But I had seen the rumblings that he was going to WCW. Did you know heading into that show, or were you like us, kind of just, oh, maybe, but I don't know?
Oh, no, it was major headline news all over Canada for a couple of weeks leading up to the show.
Okay.
Like, as soon as he had announced that his contract was up and he was going to WCW, it was literally front page news in Canada, like everywhere. It was major mainstream news. So yeah, we knew what was happening, but I mean, you know, we didn't know what was going to happen, of course, to that extent. Like all we knew was that Bret Hart was leaving, and something bad was probably going to go down as a result.
Did you, or, well, I know you didn't, but do you know anyone who got pissed off enough that they just started watching WCW exclusively and just kind of turned on the WWF?
Yeah, actually, a lot of fans were pissed off. I mean, I was, my opinion changed since then to sympathize a lot more with Bret. But I mean, at the time, like we didn't know the reasoning behind it. Like all that came out was, oh, Bret is leaving for WCW when his contract is up. And you know, it wasn't until the movie came out that we got all the
kind of shady dealings with Vince McMahon and the contracts and everything that came out. So, I mean, I was quite bitter towards Brett, actually, at the time when it went down, because it was, the perception was, you know, Brett made this choice to go to WCW, and it was his own fault, basically, for what happened to him. So, later on, of course, when once everything came out, my opinion changed. But, no, I was... I felt very betrayed by Bret Hart when that happened.
That's pretty unique. You don't really hear that kind of opinion from particularly from Canadian fans who thought it was Bret's fault from the beginning. That's very unique. That's kind of a unique opinion. You don't hear very much.
People on my blog have gleefully went back and found the postings from that time too, where I was talking about that, and you know, because of course I became such a crusader for the other side later on. But yeah, no, At the time, it was the feeling was that, yeah, Brett was betraying the country, basically.
One of the time periods we're in right now with our vintage vaults is 2000. Obviously, one of the hottest periods for the company, January on. At the time, I know, just through your writing, you are obviously a big Triple H fan in 2000. What are some of your most memorable matches from that run of his? And just so you know, Scott, the other Scott is a massive Triple H fan to this day.
I'm a fan of any year. So,
so just to know you're getting into with this discussion, but and also WrestleMania. What are your thoughts that year on, you know, was it a letdown for how hot the product was? And also, what would you have done with that main event? Were you okay with the four way and saving Austin for Backlash, or was that something you thought they should have done at Mania?
Well, as a fan, I mean, obviously we were all waiting for. For The Rock to come back and get his revenge on Triple H. The Triple H Stephanie regime was pretty awesome stuff as far as storyline goes. I mean, they built and built and built and built that, and it was, you know, just a fantastic build. And the problem was that I think WrestleMania was kind of situated at a point where it felt like it needed to be blown off, and it just wasn't the right time for it. Because, I mean, obviously, they were, in hindsight, they were right to do what they did, because Backlash did a gigantic buy rate off that, and, you know, the match was awesome between Triple H and The Rock, where Rock finally got his revenge. So, I mean, you know, that ended up working out okay, but watching that show, especially after the six-hour pregame show, you know, me and my super nerd friends were, you know, enduring the whole thing, and after all that build-up to it, and then Triple H wins, and it's like, okay, so that just happened. But, I mean, I was famously quoted as saying Triple H is God in 2001. So at the time, I was, unironically, a very big Triple H fan.
Yes.
And really, it wasn't until 2002 onwards that it kind of developed into the hate-hate relationship that I have with him today. But 2000 was such an awesome time to watching as a fan as well. I mean, like the 10-man tag in Dallas remains one of the best matches ever to air on Raw. And the Jericho fake title switch with Triple H as well was just a fantastic bit of TV. And if it hadn't been for the fact that we were waiting for Rock to come back and get his revenge, then I still to this day think that Jericho should have got the title there. But again, it's like you had so many great opportunities to beat Triple H and you know, just couldn't have done all of them. Like, you know, you had to save up something for Rock to come back. And, you know, even small stuff like the match with Triple H and Taka Michinoku, where,
yes,
you know, like that was just a great random moment in the show's history too. You know, so obviously they're kind of firing on all cylinders at that point after Russo left, and most of it was because of the one writer, Chris Kresge, who had everything storyboarded to death and a great mind for the business. And it was just a fabulous time to be a fan until everything went down the tubes in 2001.
Well, then even with, you know, we just talked about King of the Ring a couple of weeks ago, and one of the rare kind of missteps in 2000 with that tournament. Still don't know really what they were thinking, but the level of talent they had involved and the way they went with it was just kind of curious.
Yeah, that was a weird show. That was the one with the six-man?
Yeah, the six-man main event.
Yeah. No, I barely even remember that show outside of the main event. I don't know. It's especially because, like, Fully Loaded was like a really awesome show to follow up on that too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, yeah, they would do like two or three really great pay per views in a row, it seems like, and then falter out for some reason. Like WrestleMania was kind of a was kind of a misstep, oddly enough. And then they had that great Backlash and the great Jericho Benoit match on the one after that too. And yeah, it was such a weird stipulation too, to have like the title on the line and the sixth man and put it back on Triple H, and they were following up on the what was the one before that?
The Iron Man.
The Iron Man match. Yeah, yeah, that was a great match too. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I don't know what happened there with that one. It was a weird place to take the storyline.
It was a year where they should have just went by the book with a lot of things, and it seems like whenever they tried to veer off it a little bit, that's when things kind of got shaky. But when they kind of played it straight with the level of talent and the storytelling they had is when they were at their best.
Yeah, exactly. Like I say, because the guy Kresge, who was writing it, he was, you know, he was a very, very rigidly storyboarded writer, and he had like a lot of success doing that. Like, you know, A went to B, went to C, and everything made sense. And they're kind of doing a little bit like that this year with the Daniel Bryan, Randy Orton, John Cena stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So where they're, you know, there's not much in terms of surprise factor to it or anything like that, but everything, you know, it was a storyline that flowed from one to the other, and everything they did made sense. So it was people. I think the surprise is overrated in a lot of cases like that. Like if you give people what they're expecting in a good way, then things work out well.
Right. Sometimes it's just best to stay the course.
Yeah, exactly. Although I don't know what happened with in 2000, I think the worst offender, though, for that was the Triple H, Stephanie, Kurt Angle love triangle, which got botched so completely badly.
Yes, that's where I wanted to go next, actually. I wanted to see, because a lot of people look at the Invasion as the one that kind of sunk things and turned things around, but I think you can really argue that the botching of that love triangle is what did it. And I know you've been a proponent of that, too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was so obvious that the way it should have went, and you know, Kurt Angle should have got Stephanie, and that's where they should have went. And I think it was an ego thing with Triple H, to be honest, is what happened. He didn't want to be perceived as the guy who lost her.
Let's rewind for a minute, quick, Scott. Probably we've talked about one of the seminal moments as a Canadian wrestling fan in history, which is Montreal. The other one happened a couple years later, the night Owen died. What was your thoughts as a fan and as a person, and then what was the country's feeling after that happened in Kansas City?
Yeah, it was mainstream news here. The weird thing was that I didn't even know about it until well after the fact. I was working late that night, and I hadn't heard anything about it. And I got home, and my roommate was like, and they had been watching Over the Edge. I was like, oh, anything happened? And they're like, oh, Owen Hart died. And I was like, what? Like, what are you talking about? Owen Hart died. Like, are you sure it's not an angle? And like, then, you know, no, he was apparently rappelling from the ceiling and fell down and died. And it's like, how do you process that as a fan? You know, because I mean, Owen Hart was literally somebody I had watched since day one of his career.
Right.
And I'd seen nearly every major match that he'd ever had, and I'd followed him through Japan and seen him develop as a wrestler, and you know, it was such a weird feeling that, you know, this person I'd basically grown up with watching on TV was gone now like that. And that was, you know, I was a tough one as a fan, and I mean, I still blame Vince McMahon to this day for that one. It's completely Vince's fault 100% as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it was arrogance on the part of the company. It was an unnecessary stunt that really didn't need to be done. And it sucks that Owen was in a position that he felt like he had to say yes. I mean, you should never be in that position at work where you feel like you have to say yes to something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
In any line of work. You know, we'll get off this morbid topic quickly, but any other, you know, wrestlers passing away shook you up like Owen may have? Like, to me, Brian Pillman in 97 was the one that really got to me. And also Eddie Guerrero in 05. I was at kind of a weird spot. I just turned 25 and, you know, kind of, it's your first kind of quarter life crisis. At least I experienced that at 25. I don't know, Scott, if you can remember that long back, maybe if you went through the same thing. But Eddie passing right as I turned 25, like, really freaked me out for some reason. I couldn't sleep for like a week just thinking about that. But anything like that, Scott, any other guy that really kind of got to you after Owen?
Well, I mean, aside from the obvious one, Sesmo, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. But
yeah.
That Eddie was at a point when I was kind of drifting away from wrestling, so it didn't hit me as hard as you would think. The Brian Pillman one was that was nasty though too, because they announced that one before the pay per view, and people thought that it was like, again, this was like something they were making up as part of the show or something like that. But and the thing with Brian was you could see it was coming too. Like, I mean, he was in such rough shape, and he had the surgeries, and he seemed like his life had been falling apart. And it was one where it was obvious it was coming. British Bulldog was another one, I think, too, where, I mean, especially when you found out later everything that was going on
mm-hmm.
with him and how sad it was becoming. But, I mean, he was another one where he was a lot bigger in Canada, I'm sure, than he was in the U.S. And he was somebody who was around doing indies and that kind of thing. And, I mean, I go to the local shows here and watching Harry Smith as a very young wrestler developing, and then having to hear about his dad passing like that. That one hit a lot of people hard here too, I'd say.
Where do you think Pillman would have went if he had stayed alive in 98? Do you think he would have been one of their biggest stars in 98? Do you think he would have been aligned with Austin? It was a little bit of fantasy booking there.
It's tough to say, because I mean his body was shot regardless. It's like the Eddie Guerrero question.
Mm-hmm.
People have a lot of time, right? They're like, oh, well, where would Eddie Guerrero have gone? And it's like, well, his heart was going to explode one way or another. Like, if he hadn't died that day, it's not like he would have come back to wrestling and been fine. I mean, like, he was done as a wrestler. And I know Steve Austin would have brought Brian Pillman, along for the ride as much as he could have. Like, mm-hmm. Pillman would have been a much bigger star just, by osmosis with Austin, I think. But, I mean, Pillman was really done in 96 as far as that goes with the Hummer accidents and everything surrounding that, I'd say.
During this time, obviously there was a third promotion during this whole period that was kind of shaking things up until they closed up shop in early 01. Scott, when was your first taste of ECW?
Well, my roommate at the time in the 90s was a huge ECW mutant. He would get all the weekly TV shows imported from the States, and I would have to watch all of them. And so I wasn't a big fan of ECW, but yeah, I've seen nearly every episode of it because my roommate was a giant fan of it. So I was like, my initial exposure to it was on my giant satellite dish. I'd be watching on the America One Network because they would mm-hmm. carry that every week. And I just kind of followed along with it, and through the TNN era until it died. And I appreciated having another outlet at the time for wrestling, but by the end it was pretty sad stuff. Like when he was putting Tammy Sitch on TV and talking about her drug issues and that kind of thing on national TV. Like,
right.
I don't want to. There's nothing I want to see. It stopped being edgy in 98, 99 because WWF had pretty much appropriated the whole style and was making a lot more money off it than Paul Heyman ever did. So. Mm. I mean, they had a good run of things though, and I mean, like, it barely legal was an exciting time to be a fan because all my friends were just going crazy to get their hands on it, and I ended up making a zillion copies of that pay per view for people as well. So I guess I did pretty good off of it.
Hey, speaking of Tammy,
I probably made more money off that pay per view than Paul Heyman did.
Better watch out; he might be calling you. Well, he's doing all right now, but. Speaking of Tammy Sitch, Scott, how much would you pay to cuddle up with her on a bed for a picture nowadays?
I don't know where she's been lately, so...
How much would you have paid in 1996?
In 1996, I would have paid some money, yes.
A kidney or a lung or something? That's probably what I would have.
I was a big fan of Sunny at the time, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
As mm-hmm. everybody
big
else.
Time. I mean, how sad... has her downfall been? I mean, look, a lot of wrestlers have had substance issues, obviously. I mean, it's pretty well documented, but hers is just, it's hard to wrap your head around how she went from being so top to so bottom.
Yeah, and then the sad thing is if you go back and watch the Smoky Mountain stuff where she's, 19-year-old manager coming up there, and it's just like, how did she not become one of the biggest stars in the business? Like even bigger than she was. And at the time when she was big in WWF, I mean, she was an appreciably big star. And it's like, but you watch all of this potential that she had, and it's just like, my God, it should have been like Sable, where they built the division around her, and you know, made TV shows about her on the E Network and stuff. She should have been like somebody with limitless potential to go past the sport and become like an actress or an actual big mainstream star, and she just wasted her whole career. I think a lot of it was Chris Candido, actually, too. She hooked up to the wrong person.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you know, even after he died, she had her personality and substance problems, and just kind of wrecked her own career. Maybe she should talk to DDP and see if would help.
Join the crib. Because we have Kevin Kelly on here regularly, and he just said guys would just be in awe of Sonny in 96 and 97 backstage, like just literally standing there, mouths like drooped, staring at her. Like, that's just how the presence she had at that time.
Yeah, exactly. Although after I heard the story about Ahmed Johnson and Candido, I don't think I can take her the same way anymore.
There's a lot of stories out there, out in the sleaze thread or whatnot, that...
There is a lot, yes.
Probably don't want to believe. But all right, so we go back to 01 now. Invasion happens. WCW is bought. Feelings when it closed, did you think it could have been saved, or did you think it was just time for WCW to go?
I was cheering for it to die for a long time. It was... By the time they got to the end with with the powers that be and the Russo and Bischoff thing and Sid Vicious jumping off the top rope and breaking his leg and the boy bands and the Kiss Demon, it's like, it was the worst to be as a recapper, because just like, you couldn't pay me to watch that crap anymore at that point, and I was just like, somebody put this promotion out of their misery, please. There was, you know, talk at the time that Bischoff was going to buy it and join up with Jason Hervey and Fusions and everything like that to do something, but it's like, look at what Bischoff has done with TNA now, and you're telling me that they're going to survive, you know, that WCW would have survived with Bischoff running it again? I really don't think so. Although, ironically, I was, one of the only times I've ever pursued a job in the business was with the WCW Home to Video division in 1999, where they were Jason Hervey's company was approaching me about moving to California and doing something with the home video division.
Hmm.
And the day after they called me, they shut down the division. they're going to arrange something, and I called their office back, and they're like, "Oh yeah, we're shutting down. We're not going to do home videos anymore." Good thing I didn't go down to California.
Yes.
Yikes.
Is how much money did they leave on the table? You know, we'll get to WWF, how much they left on the table in 01, but how much money did WCW leave on the table with mismanagement? I'm not even talking about the spending of money on contracts and all that. I'm just talking about just the poor management of the roster, the lack of merchandising. They were a little bit ahead of the game with the web and the internet kind of stuff, but it seemed like there's so many areas that they just did not pay enough attention to that they could have really just made serious bank on in those years.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, look at all the ways that WWE has diversified their incomes in the years there. Like, you know, they don't even need the wrestling business anymore. They do all this other, you know, stuff on the fringes of the wrestling business, and that's where they make all their money now. And WCW totally missed the boat on all that kind of thing. And as well, WCW threw away money just on completely ridiculous things, like, you know, the famous stories from Vince Russo's day about how they would buy a $100,000 limousine and blow it up for absolutely no reason, right? Like, you know, crazy things like that. Like, they could have saved, you know, $4 or $5 million in a year just by reining in that ridiculous kind of stuff. They had brought in, for near the end, instead of something like, you know, Russo or Bischoff, if they brought in Bill Watts, just from a financial standpoint, the company might still be alive today, because, you know, they wouldn't be making very much money, but they sure as hell wouldn't be losing any.
To me, that was a turning point for them in April of 2000. Instead of trying to go a little bit more conservative and rebuild, maybe, you know, if they had someone with a little bit of vision that saw, you know what, WWF is red hot now. There's going to come a time where that's going to taper. Let's kind of build for the future now. And you know, I know it's tough with that corporate environment and the ratings and all that, but if they would have toned it down, like you said, with a guy like Watts and just slashed it back down and kind of rebuilt slowly, I think going back to the well with Bischoff and Russo is what really buried them for good.
Yeah, exactly. They could have kept reading ECW for a while. Like I know Rob Van Dam was trying really hard to come in near the end of WCW, for instance, and Bischoff was going to push in as a giant star. That would have been a very, very smart move,
mm-hmm.
I think. So that would have been a good direction to go in. Like the leftover ECW guys that were there, if they'd brought them in and gone in a totally different direction,
right.
You know, not even like that extreme direction or anything like that, but just something different as an alternative to what WWF was putting out, right? Like, you know, because WCW was, you know, WWF Junior for years and years, you know, and the way that Jim Cornette always talks about it when his interviews is like, well, you know, they would hire, you know, WWF sound guy and their WWF lighting guy and WWF's referees and all the way down to the catering guy trying to find a way to duplicate their success, right? You know, and it's like, at what point do you do something different, you know? Like, if you're always playing catch-up with them, then how can you ever think that you're going to, you know, do better than what WWF was ever going to do by using their cast-offs? But that was always WCW logic, right? It was, well, these guys were a star in WWF, so we're going to bring them in and give them a huge push and then tailor our product around them and look where that ended up with them.
All right, now this is probably one of the most over-talked-about topics of all time, but we got to touch on it. The invasion. Could they have done anything? Was there any chance with this thing?
Well, you know, one of the taboo things on my blog now is rebooking the invasion. It's been done to death so many times by so many people. That's one of my buttons to push to make sure the email never gets posted to your blog. But
well, we're putting you in the spot right now. So
yeah,
I'm friends with some of the writers, and I was fortunate enough to have a lot of contact with people inside at the time, who were sharing with me all sorts of plans that they had, and it was pretty cool ideas. Like when it was first happening, the plans at the time was to launch a separate company. Like SmackDown was going to become WCW, basically, or Raw was going to become WCW. It was never really clear which way they were going to go exactly. But yeah, they were actually going to launch a second company with the WCW guys, and you know, you move Triple H over there, and he would be the big star of that group, and then the original group would have The Rock as their big star, and things were set in motion. It would have been very interesting. I think that could have worked, because the one thing that wrestling fans always want to have is competition. Whether or not you have two groups that actually hate each other, they want to believe that there's two groups that actually hate each other.
Right.
And every time that something like that has been teased or happened, it always makes money. And, you know, even if it's as lame as the Invasion pay-per-view ended up being, it still did a gigantic buy rate because people want to believe, right? So, I mean, if they had done that, all they had to do was let WCW be a viable entity, you know, put it out there. And even if WWF then went on TV and they're like, oh, my God, WCW sucks so badly and blah, blah, blah. But as long as they weren't actually demonstrating that WCW sucked and doing it on their own program, then it would have been fine because you would have built up a rivalry. But, you know, of course, the problem was then they would bury it on their own TV show until, you know, people believe that they were just a bunch of jobbers who had no chance against the WWF. And that's what we ended up with.
Did the Austin heel turn help or hurt it? Should Austin have been the, considering he was the guy that got kicked out of, you know, that got fired out of WCW, if he was the torchbearer for the WWF and WCW actually, and Vince actually paid the big contracts because he left a bunch of those guys on the table, the Nashes and all those guys, and he maybe brought one or two of them in to spearhead the other side, do you think it would have maybe had some, been more successful and maybe could have lasted beyond the storyline, or was it dead to begin with?
They only needed two people, like from the start, like especially with Austin, right? The problem was that Austin never should have been a part of the whole invasion thing. Like the Austin heel turn, heel turn might have been fine, but he got mixed up with the invasion, and it was too much stuff going on at the same time. Like, it was, you know, too many ideas too many big ideas kind of being floated around at the same time, and they should have picked one or the other as far as their focus and just let it be there. But, like, really, the WCW guys, the cheap ones that they brought in were fine, like, you know, your Hurricanes and guys like that nobody gives a shit about in the grand scheme of things. But for all they did, all they should have done was brought in, spent whatever money they needed to bring in Bill Goldberg and had Ric Flair as his manager. And just bring those two guys in, and you could set up Goldberg versus Steve Austin and repave Titan Towers with, you know, gold and platinum then, if you want to, from all the money that they would have brought in. Because you could have probably done 1.5 million buys if they had managed to get those two together at WrestleMania. And unfortunately, it wasn't going to work out because of Goldberg's contract, but I still think to this day that Goldberg would have paid off and justified his entire contract with two pay-per-view appearances, especially if they put him in there against Austin. Like, they would have been a license to print money.
I agree totally. If they did a two-match series, or even if you do the Rock thing earlier, if you do Austin at one point and then the Rock, just those two matches alone would have definitely made him money. And, like, you know, like we've always said, they ended up bringing all these guys in anyway, so it ended up...
exactly. They brought him eventually, so, yeah, I was like, drop the money on Goldberg, you know, make your $10 to $15 million off your two pay-per-views, and there you go, contract's paid for, done.
So we head into early 02, obviously, and then Hogan comes back, the NWO comes back, we get Hogan Rock. Just memories of that match and the whole thing, Hogan's kind of return there. Were you over it quickly, or were you buying into the Hulkamania nostalgia?
I was not buying into Hulkamania. No, I was. I'm so hot and cold on that match. I ended up liking it a lot later on, but I mean, yeah. At the time, it was kind of exciting to watch, but I saw right through the whole Hulkamania Renaissance thing. And I did actually predict at the time. I said the night after WrestleMania, I said they got to get the title on this guy quick, because people are going to start seeing through it really fast. And when that happens, then it's going to end. And that's exactly what happened. Although, I mean, I got to say, I didn't think that it would die as fast as it did. I thought the Hogan thing had like 2 or 3 months of life in it. And like, if they, you know, they pulled the trigger and put the title on, you know, they'd be able to get a couple of shows out of him. I mean, I didn't suspect that they would put the title on him and it would just die off literally within days of getting that belt on him.
Do you think it had anything? Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. No.
No, so do you think it had anything to do with the feud they set up for him with The Undertaker? Like, do you think if they, I'm trying to think of another guy he could have worked with for a couple of months. I'm just trying to think if there's a way to get him to Brock with the title and have Brock be the one that destroys him for the belt. Or do you think Brock and over Rock meant more anyway?
Yeah, I think Brock and Rock meant more as far as that goes. But it's just, the Hogan thing was just one of those things you can't predict. It's just like, the zeitgeist was gone. It was like seemingly overnight. You know, it was like he was one day he was getting the 10-minute standing ovations on Raw coming out, and then the next day people were just sick of him. And it was like it literally was like it, just like that. Like just one day later, and people had seen what they wanted to see from Hogan, and they were ready to move on to the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, when that happened, he was still the champion. And business just died around him.
Do you think it was around that time and heading into 03 that they really missed their opportunity to elevate some of those newer guys and kind of I know you've been a big fan of saying in 03 when Brock and Angle were on top about changing that main event style over to more of a, you know, MMA or mat-based style. Do you think they really missed that opportunity and went to this window where they were out of guys to take over because they kind of bypassed a whole generation?
Yeah, that was a weird time because, yeah, they were trying to bring in all these new guys, and the old guys weren't around to do anything for them, because, you know, Triple H wasn't going to do it. And, I mean, Hogan did his best, right? I mean, I'll give him that. Like, you know, in 02, he put Brock over like a monster. And, he put Kurt Angle over as well. So, I mean, it wasn't his fault that he didn't have anything left to give as far as that goes. But, I mean, and Hogan did the deal with Edge, as a tag team where he gave him the rub
mm-hmm.
as best he could. So, I mean, Hogan knew the deal. Like, Hogan seemed to know that he was kind of done at that point and what his role was going to be, and he was doing the best he could with it. But, I mean, like, guys like Undertaker weren't going to do very much outside of the Jeff Hardy match, it didn't seem like. And Rock had moved on, and Austin had moved on. And those were the guys that you would think would be the ones to make the new generation, and kind of started that trend, which I think is what made Vince kind of gun-shy to this day about making new stars like that, where Rock and Austin became bigger than the business and then just kind of left and didn't leave Vince with anything. Especially Austin, of course, with the way that everything went down there with his departure was, kind of, I think that really hurt Vince. And I think that's why we don't get a lot of the John Cena Superman types anymore, where they're allowed to be bigger than the business, because Vince doesn't want that. He doesn't want somebody who's going to stand up to him and go do his own thing.
Okay, it's fitting, Scott, that I'm the one that asks you this question. So, what was it in 2002 that switched your opinion of Triple H?
Probably the Reign of Terror was the main thing. It was just watching those Raws over and over again, and Triple H never losing and burying the guys over and over. It became a death march, basically, watching those shows. And SmackDown wasn't much better at that point, but it was such an uninspired period of TV to be sitting through, I guess, is the thing. And Triple H was the guy who was on top of it, and the guy who was just gaining power behind the scenes too, and not being shy about expressing it on TV.
Who do you think he should have lost to in that stretch?
Definitely RVD. Everything was being set up for RVD to be the guy at that point. Like, they had a super hot thing with Rob. They set everything up to unify all the titles together. Like, they unified the hardcore European Intercontinental title into one to be this super title, and Triple H didn't want to have that title, so he created his own belt, and then they gave that belt to Rob to set it up for him to be the guy, and then Triple H decided that Rob was not going to be the guy and beat him, and that kind of killed him off for a few years. And then, of course, the Booker T was the one where I really thought that Triple H should have just lost. Like, just like everything in the build up to it and the bullying of him and kind of scapegoating him, but everything with WCW, it seemed like, on top of him, that it kind of felt like, just the way they were pushing him as this, the guy who was representative of WCW and everything, and then just beating him to WrestleMania after making him take a pedigree and lay there for like 5 minutes afterwards. It was ridiculous. And then, Triple H's logic afterwards was, I had to save the belt for Goldberg, but it seemed like with him, it was always saving the belt for somebody else, right?
Right.
Couldn't lose to Rob Van Dam because we were saving it for the Kane thing. Couldn't lose to Kane because we were saving it for the Booker T feud. Couldn't lose to Booker T because we were saving it for Goldberg. Couldn't lose for Goldberg at SummerSlam because I want to lose to him here. And,
that's the worst one right there, that SummerSlam. They should have called it audible in that match. They really should have.
That just sucked the life out of me as a fan watching that. Bringing in Goldberg for these millions of dollars, and this guy who even The Rock laid down for,
mm-hmm.
Do it clean, and then of course Triple H had to be the one to beat him.
And it's ridiculous too, because if you're looking at it purely from a selfish point of view for Triple H, doesn't it make more sense to lose in a setting like that than to lose one-on-one the next month? I mean, you're banged up, you're taken out of the match with the glass and six other guys involved. To me, that's the perfect opportunity to drop the belt, if you're looking from a selfish point of view.
Yeah, I mean, he wouldn't have made him look weak or anything like that, or whatever his justification for it at the time was. I'm not sure, but yeah, it was just, it was the perfect time to build up to the loss, and to this day, I really don't understand what the thinking was there behind it.
Just one more thing on RVD. Do you think even a year earlier they missed the boat on? I mean, I know it was tough to take the belt off Austin at that point in late 01, but at that No Mercy pay per view when he was just red hot, Rob Van Dam.
He was smoking hot at that point. I know he was the biggest thing. I mean, from behind the scenes standpoint, there was a lot of heat on him for working too stiff and breaking guys' noses and things like that. But it's like, who gives a shit? You know, like as a wrestling fan, I don't care if a guy's, you know, not working proper WWF style or doesn't shake hands or whatever bullshit excuse that they come up with these things, right? Like this is why the business is in the state that it is, because they let themselves get so focused on this kind of nonsense instead of, you know, actually drawing money with a guy,
mm-hmm.
which they did. Like No Mercy did a pretty big buy rate for just for sticking Rob Van Dam in there out of nowhere, and mm-hmm. yeah, they should have put the belt on him and just seen where it went to.
So as the greatest title reign ever was ended by that bum Goldberg. No, I'm just kidding. we head to 2004, and your guy, and the awesome reviews you wrote, you were not ashamed to say your guy, Chris Benoit, wins the Rumble in an unbelievable moment in Philly. And JR and I had the privilege, and we're saying this in hindsight, obviously, to be at the Garden and watch that triple threat. What were your thoughts watching that match and then the moment when Triple H, well, there's two moments. The first one is when Benoit knocks Sean out and he's got his back to Triple H, and Triple H is slowly getting up, and literally everyone in the Garden's like, oh, because you all know, you all thought what was coming. And then obviously put him in the crossface, and then the moment Triple H tapped out. What was your feeling that night watching that show, knowing that the guy that you've been following for a long time finally hit the big time, hit the top?
Yeah, it was awesome. Especially, you know, the same group of friends who had been watching Benoit get, like, screwed out of all this stuff in WCW month after month, and it was just, you know, killing us, ripping our hearts out as fans, seeing it, and then finally get the payoff. And, I mean, I knew it was happening months in advance. Like, and the people I were talking to, it tipped me off, basically, that that this was gonna happen, so, you know, don't lose faith, and like that. But, you know, still actually seeing them pull the trigger on it after all those years was pretty stunning, because it was like, I didn't think that they would ever actually go through with it. But yeah, it was like the Royal Rumble, I think, was a bigger one than WrestleMania actually for us, because once he won the Rumble, then it was kind of a foregone conclusion that it was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it was still awesome, but I mean, it was like having him actually come in at number one, and because, you know, the Rumble is, you know, it's a tradition. It's much more of a fun match than WrestleMania is, even, I think, just watching at a group setting and things like that. But, you know, we were cheering him on for, you know, an entire 60-minute match, and then he actually won the thing, and there was no... Usually you prepare yourself for the letdown. It's like, you know, oh, man, they screwed him over again. And it's like, well, there was no come down. Like, he went in there for 60 minutes, and he won the match. And
mm-hmm.
we were just, you know, we didn't know how to react to that. It was awesome, and it's like, well, shit, now he's going to win the world title, I bet. And he did, and, you know, we were sitting there in the apartment and chanting, you know, tap, 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 along with everybody else in the Garden when he got Triple H into that crossface. And the moment with him and Eddie was pretty spectacular at the end of WrestleMania, and unfortunately it didn't turn out well for either of them.
Did it seem like a foregone conclusion, though, Scott, because the situation almost was the same as the year before with Goldberg. I mean, Backlash was in Edmonton, and there were, you know, there might have been a rumbling or two, and I remember JR and I were talking about this back then, where they're going to pull off some kind of, you know, they're going to pull off some kind of switcheroo where, like, Sean wins or something, and then Benoit wins it the next month in Edmonton, so he can have it in front of his home crowd. Did that ever enter into your mind during that stretch?
No, I mean, it's kind of... We knew it was going to happen. Like, it was the Rumble winner traditionally would go on to win the belt, and we weren't that cynical about it at that point, I don't think. But I mean, you never 100% believe it until it actually happens, and you actually see it with your own eyes. But I mean, like, but I mean, we knew then after he won the Rumble, they were serious about doing this with him. They wouldn't waste it, you know, that kind of thing on him if they were going to then pull the trigger and put the title on him at WrestleMania, I think. So. Kind of we kind of knew, but I mean, you know, it's you know, again, a thing where you don't actually 100% believe it until you see it with your own eyes. But we were pretty confident that you know it was going to happen.
All right, Scott.
I believe I remember correctly, the header of your WrestleMania 20 review was The Curse of the Vanilla Midgets. So so I think it was fitting that Kevin Nash called them at some point ended up being at the top of the mountain that night. So it was very fitting.
Yeah, it was a very fitting night.
All right, Scott, putting you on the spot again. Better Rumble match, 92 or 04?
Well, I mean, you know, now of course I consider 92 the better one, but 04 was pretty awesome. Like they had some pretty wicked spots in the 04 one. I mean, and the ending of 04 was pretty memorable too. You know, taking out the Big Show with the guillotine choke, and there was some pretty awesome eliminations from Benoit there too over the course of that one. But I mean, I think 92 overall has the more iconic one. Just from Bobby Heenan's commentary alone,
mm-hmm.
you know, going through that one. It's, you know, that was again one where I didn't have the opportunity to watch it live. I didn't get to see it until, you know, it was on tape after, and they had edited out Hogan's reactions from the crowd and everything like that. But just Bobby Heenan freaking out and praying to the gods during the course of the match. Mm. You know, it seemed like he was as invested in the match as the fans were.
Mm-hmm.
I think that made it a really special one to watch, because, you know, you could tell he was as nervous as anybody else. And it's just a, you know, Flair against 29 other guys who all hated him. And there was something to be said for that storyline.
Looking back, I mean, was 92 just one of the best WWF pay-per-view years of all time? Those four events are all very, very good.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a good time to be a fan as well. The heyday of the Flair thing, and Piper finally getting his title and going up against Bret Hart at WrestleMania. You know, then Hogan finally leaving. So that was good. Sid Justice could have been something if he hadn't screwed it up too. So yeah, that was a good time to be a fan as well. Absolutely.
So getting back to your career now, around the 2002-2003 stretch is when you were asked to pick up and finish the Buzz on pro wrestling. Seemed to open the door to you for doing some other publishing, some of your books. How were you first approached on that, and was it something you proactively looked at, or just kind of fell in your lap?
Yeah, it just kind of fell in my lap. I got an email from the editor of Goldberg's autobiography. He had a couple of very minor fact-checking things that he needed checked on, Scott Hall, I want to make sure, you know, Scott Hall uses the cattle prod on Kevin Nash, on Goldberg, I should say, to salute that Goldberg could beat him, you know, that kind of thing. And I was talking with the editor, and he was mentioning that there was this book about on pro wrestling that somebody else was writing, and they weren't sure if the author was going to be able to finish it. Could I help out with this? And I was like, okay, sure, I can probably do a chapter. And then as it turned out, the guy bailed completely, and I had a great little book. So that was nice. And then, so the editor of that book actually quit his job with Random House and became a literary agent and took me with him as a client. So from that point, then he would ship my book ideas around, and I had another four books after that as well.
Which one was your most successful?
Most successful was Tonight in the Spirit Ring. That was the highest selling one. The second one, that would have been.
Mm, I have that. It's an excellent book. Very well done.
So now, in 05, 06, you start to kind of fall out of things a little bit. You give up finally on Raw, the rants. Where were you at just mentally as a wrestling fan at that point? Was it more life getting in the way, or were you really just losing interest in what WWE was presenting? And how much did the Classics on Demand kind of save you as a fan, coming around the same time your interest was waning in the product?
Yeah, I was totally burned out on the product in 05. And I mean, I got married in early 05 as well. So I mean, I was developing a personal life away from wrestling. I had moved provinces, so the friends that I was watching wrestling with were, you know, in another province now. So I was kind of away from the people who had been my friends as fans, and my wife wasn't really interested in wrestling. So it was something that was no longer part of my daily routine. And it, you know, made, once you get out of the habit of something like that, it gets easier and easier to stay out of the habit. And it was just, there was nothing on the product that was interesting to me at that point. It's kind of the rise of John Cena, which it just totally turned me off as a fan of that. I was never a fan of Cena's coming out. But I mean, I was a fan of his early on in 03 when he first started out. In fact, I predicted that he was going to be a gigantic star. I mean, even then, my predictions were kind of undershooting the mark as to what a huge star that he eventually became. But I mean, I was with him as the when he was, you know, doing the Macklemore white rapper gimmick, which was extremely entertaining at the time, and it was neat to follow him up the ladder as a fan. You know, I always call it the rocket push, right? You know, they strap a rocket to a guy's ass and pick up the car, and it's always neat to be along the ride for that, right? You know, you can be like, oh, yeah, I was a fan of his when he started, and then it's, when he gets to the top, you can say that, you know, you were there since the beginning, but, you know, then with Cena, he became a totally different wrestler at that point and just totally bored me as a fan. And there was nothing there for me, and Kurt Angle was losing his mind and getting ready to leave, so yeah. it wasn't much there anymore. So definitely Classics on Demand became a saving grace as a wrestling fan, because I was able to start watching World Championship Wrestling from the start, like all the things that I'd wanted to watch as a kid. Basically, it was very high in nostalgia factor there with those ones. I could go back and kind of relive the stuff that I'd seen when I was 12 years old or whatever, watching, you know, late at night on TV after my parents had gone to bed. So that was a very cool experience as a fan, and kept giving me content to pump out on my blog too, which was nice.
Turning to Cena just for a minute, where does he rank all time for you, just not as a fan, but I mean just as within the business itself? You know, there's Hogan, there's Austin, there's Rock. I mean, where has Cena now reached? For as many people that can't stand him, just look at him from a successful business point of view. Where do you see him kind of on the Mount Rushmore of WWF legacy?
Oh, yeah, he's right up there. I mean, I've never denied, you know, Cena's ability as a draw, obviously. I mean, he's one of the biggest draws in history. He's been on top of the company for 8 years and counting. And, I mean, he's a great worker in the ring. For the most part, he always delivers in big pay-per-views. He's an awesome human being who, you know, does things like fills up a Humvee full of toys and drops it off at a children's hospital. Like, how do you hate that? You don't. You know, I mean, like, he's a saint, but it's just, the character is just so off-putting, you know? Like, that's the whole thing. It's all he would need would be a heel turn, and I'd be fine with him again, but...
Do you think it would work still at this point? Like, do you think we're past that point, or I mean, what kind of heel would he have to be to really make it click?
He could. It's an easy thing. He would just have to be the arrogant jock heel.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the where he comes out and does his amusing little babyface promos, but he does it as a heel. Like he comes out and points out the things that everybody's saying about him. You know, like he's the best looking guy, and like all the women love him and the men hate him, right? Like, you know, that kind of Rick Rude arrogance that, the star football player mentality, I guess, like that kind of thing, like the arrogant NFL quarterbacks. And then there's, obviously a lot of them right now that people hate in real life. So, you know, if they should play off that kind of thing, play off the hatred that he already has, and especially up against somebody like Daniel Bryan, who's such an everyman character, right? I think it would be a perfect dynamic.
Now you got pretty much into MMA, and you still are. And even at one point, you started doing some rants on old UFC shows. Are you still into UFC or MMA?
Absolutely.
And what brought you back into reviewing wrestling from that again?
They're two totally different things. I mean, MMA kind of filled a gap that wrestling didn't have for me anymore, I guess is the easiest way to describe it. I was watching UFC from the start. Like my roommate would, it was a weekly tradition of us. We'd get the UFC tape and, you know, pizza and alcohol and watch guys beat the shit out of each other, and it was good times. And I kind of fell away from it for a couple of years, and then, as long as everybody else kind of got back into it again with the Ultimate Fighter, and especially the even after the Forrest Griffin stuff and Bonner stuff. It was actually a lot of it was the season after that. With, the heavyweights, with the season that had like Rashad Evans winning,
mm-hmm.
and those kind of guys. Yeah, there was a lot of guys in that season that I ended up becoming kind of like lifelong fans of after that one, because that was the first season of Ultimate Fighter that I sat down and watched, and I started watching the UFC pay-per-views again. And actually before that too, the other big one that I've been following was Pride, because Pride is basically UFC with a WWE booking mentality. And it was kind of the best of both worlds for me as a fan. Because it was like, well, this is exactly what I'm looking for, right? Like, it's something with a more realistic wrestling style, but at the same time, it's still got the over-the-top characters and soap opera aspects to it. So it was, I was really kind of sad when Pride died, because that was giving me exactly everything I wanted out of both companies.
Were you, did Brock Lesnar help as well, kind of reignite your... MMA. I mean, to me, I wasn't really big into UFC. When he went there, I followed along and started watching more. Did he play that role for you at all?
More, it was George St. Pierre more for me as a Canadian, because mm-hmm. George St. Pierre is, you know, a giant star up here. Mm-hmm. Goes, yeah. That was what drew most people in Canada to watching UFC on a regular basis was George. But yeah, absolutely, Brock was a big deal too. The fight against Randy Couture did. There's a large group of people who are casual fans of UFC, and just kind of turned up for that one at my friend's house, and ended up being a packed house there that night. And it was great because they were all cheering for Randy Couture, as you know, the hardcore fight fans, and I was cheering for Brock Lesnar as a wrestling fan, and I looked like the smart one on that night. And UFC 100 was a big deal too, actually, for both of them, because I had both GSP and Brock Lesnar fighting on it. And I actually remember driving around from sports bar to sports bar here in town trying to find one that wasn't jam packed and sold out, and it was impossible. We ended up having to come back and actually order the show on pay per view, because you literally could not find anywhere to sit down at a table and watch that show, because it was such a big deal up here.
Do you think there'll ever be a time where Brock is a more regular competitor for WWE, or do you think this is the most we're going to get of him?
I'm pretty happy with the amount that is, because I mean, too much Brock and he's going to burn out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, both, you know, you're gonna run out the character, and Brock as a person is gonna get tired of it and flake out again. So I mean, I think it's the perfect amount. Doing three matches a year, you can take him off TV, and then when he comes back, he has an impact, and it's treated as a big deal every time he's on there then, and you can, you know, go back to the farm and punch out grizzly bears or whatever the hell he does when he's not being a wrestler, right? And, you know, that way he's happy, and he doesn't have to do the schedule, and he can come and he's not gonna, and I think actually it's something that they should do for a lot more of the guys,
mm-hmm.
Just because it keeps everybody fresh. They I've been advocating kind of an off season thing in wrestling for a long time now, because it's just the nightly toll on guys is just too much. And 2013, like, the guys shouldn't be killing themselves. Like, it's, you know, the 80s and it's territorial system anymore. And like, yeah, it's a different business now. Like, the guys don't need to be out there beating each other up on night after night for, you know, 5,000 people or whatever it is. You know, they should cycle them out like a TV season. You could put them on TV for 5 months and then take them off and then let them rest up for a couple months, and then you bring them back and they're instantly fresh again. You know, there's not really much in terms of a downside to it.
Do you think they're going to do a Brock and Punk rematch?
I don't think so. Last I heard, the direction was Brock and The Rock for WrestleMania. So I think whatever Punk's doing with Heyman, it's going to be somebody else other than Brock at this point. I think they had their match. It was awesome, and really doing a rematch would be overkill.
Where do you rank this year's SummerSlam with some of the best?
I consider it one of the best ever, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the best in about 11 or 12 years, at least. God, I had such a good time watching it. Like, it takes me a lot to get emotionally invested in matches these days, because I've seen everything, and, you know, I'm not particularly invested in the and the product as such. But I mean, my God, I was jumping up and down watching that Brock Punk match at SummerSlam, and it's like I was watching it the day after, so I mean, I knew who won the match and everything like that. But I was still buying into All In Your Falls, and I was just grinning like a little kid watching Brock throw him around the ring like a rag doll, and I was like, this is the way that they should have brought him in the first place, right? Like, have him go out there and be an absolute monster, beats the shit out of Punk, and he's a big bully, and Punk gets his comebacks in there and keeps fighting, and it was great. It was everything I love, Bull Pro Wrestling in one match.
What are your thoughts on Punk as a guy that could be a guy that could carry the brand of this company for the future?
Well, I mean, Punk is a guy who brought me back to wrestling in 2011. I mean, like, I was, you know, just covering classics on demand and that kind of stuff, and it was the summer of Punk that convinced me to come back because everybody was talking about him, and I watched the Pipe Bomb interview, and I was like, this guy is saying what I've been saying for years now, and I want to spend money on him. And so I did, and he enticed me to start watching Raw again, and I went to a house show that he was headlining, and I put my money down to see Punk. I mean, you know, it's like the guys hold up the signs, right? And say, I just put my asses in the seats, right? Like, that's what happened. Punk put my ass in the seat. And, you know, obviously, and the year-long title reign was an awesome thing to solidify him as a top guy. I don't know that he can be a tippy-top guy at the level of, you know, the Rocks or the Triple H's. Like, I think just because he isn't really the same kind of over-the-top cartoon character personality that you really need out of somebody who can transcend the sport. But I mean, with Cena out for 6 months, he's going to be the guy at the top. So we'll see what happens with having him up there. But I mean, he's got the charisma, and obviously he can deliver in the main events, and he can get the reactions. So I think he's got as good a shot as anybody does. But I mean, you know, who would have thunk, you know, even back in 2005, watching Ring of Honor shows and that kind of thing, that you know, CM Punk and Bryan Danielson would be the two top baby faces for WWE.
And both for different reasons. You know, Punk, you always kind of looked at him as like, this guy's never going to play the game enough to move up the ladder and be a star. He's just going to always piss people off. And the other hand, Danielson is someone that you're just like, they'll never give him a chance. And it seemed like they didn't want to give him a chance. I mean, he really forced their hand. I mean, a guy that just old school got over on his own, and they're running with it now. And anyone, and there are some out there, and I don't think it's as prevalent as maybe the straw man that's being tossed around, but anyone worried that Bryan is not being pushed or got screwed by this? I mean, he beat John Cena clean, something that very few people have done on a major show, and he's made now. He's made, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, as soon as he beat Randy Orton clean, because Randy Orton is the most protected guy I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he does not do jobs for almost anybody, and if he does a job, it's always, you know, really screwy, and he gets it back right away, and like he made Randy Orton tap out on national TV, and Orton's a guy that they walk on eggshells with as far as, you know, making sure that he's always 100% strong. So that was the real first sign that they were serious about the Daniel Bryan push. I mean, it's kind of a wacky thing with Bryan. It's like, well, we want to turn this guy into a star, so we'll have him beat a bunch of people cleanly and then give him the title, and then he'll be over. Like, wow, how about that? Why didn't I think of that sooner, huh? Good God, I should be a wrestling booker.
All right, so when you hang up the keyboard eventually someday, when you're done with all this, and, you know, you've been loved, you've been hated, you've always got a response, been a great influence on a lot of writers, what's kind of your legacy on the internet wrestling community? Do you ever think about it? Do you not really? Is it something you don't really care about? Just kind of where do you think you'll lie when you look back at this all someday?
Oh, I mean, I'll just keep doing it, I'm sure. Like, this is the site, the blog is pretty self-sustaining now, as far as that goes. So, I mean, it's not something where I'm ever gonna, you know, super retire or anything like that. Like, I'm trying to scale back my Raw reviews now as it is. I'm doing the cable cutting thing, right now as an experiment in my life. So I'm doing the 90-minute Hulu edition of Raw now instead of the three-hour one.
Mm-hmm.
Because really, it was the three-hour Raw that was just kind of killing my interest in doing it any further. So we'll see if that helps. But I don't know. I feel proud knowing that there's guys in WWE who kind of came up reading me and, you know who I am and consider me an influence and that kind of thing. So, it's, you know, that's a nice feeling, you know, knowing you're having some small amount of influence on the next generation of the sports, whether or not they're ever allowed to acknowledge you or anything like that.
Now, you've obviously your reviews are all over the net, and they could be purchased. You know, they could be procured on print, you know, on solid paper. But you've expanded to the Kindle market and have put together a bunch of compilations, including some of your older material. Talk about that. How you've gotten to that and how that worked out.
Yeah, I love the Kindle stuff. It's awesome. I got really sick of dealing with the bullshit of publishing, actually. So it was a nice, because I was talking to my publisher of after a couple of years ago. So I was looking for a Kindle edition of Dungeon of Death. See, it's because there's people who'd ask me about it, and they put one out for me, and I was looking into the Kindle thing as a result, and I discovered it was ridiculously easy to then actually publish your own Kindle books. Because I was telling the publisher, I was like, well, it's like super easy to set it up, everything, you guys should do it and put it out there and make some money off it. And I thought to myself, hey, I should make some money off of it. I like making money. So yeah, there was, because I get people, my old rants, people are always looking to buy them from me, because I had a thing set up where I would, for like, you send me, PayPal me like $20, and I would send out a file that had all the rants in it. And my webmaster / cohort / enemy Scotsman would constantly suggest to me that I should bundle these things in smaller amounts, right? Like I could make more money off of it if I say do a special on WrestleMania rants.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whatever, right? Some theme ones like that. So the Kindle one ended up being a perfect opportunity to do that, because then I could, you know, take specialized ones like the WrestleManias or the Saturday's main events and bundle them into one shot for a couple of bucks and put them off there in the Kindle thing and you know, sell them over and over again. And it's worked out very well for me so far. And like I say, it's excuse me, I can do whatever I want. I don't have to go through the publisher. I don't have to wait years to see any royalties off of it. I don't have to put pictures in the book if I don't want to. It gives me a lot of freedom, and even if I only sell a couple hundred copies, then, you know, hey, great. That's a couple hundred bucks I didn't have in my pocket before for all this no work.
Now, if someone were to say, who's this Scott Keith guy? I don't know anything about him, never read his work. And I came to you and said, hey, Scott, give me your one rant or one you know, article that you've done, because you've done some other non-review stuff like the King Lear and that kind of stuff. What is the one thing you're most proud of that you would say, here is what Scott Keith's writing is all about?
Yeah, probably. I think the two that I did, the King Lear and the Lazarus rants back in the 90s, were the ones that I'm most defined by as far as my kind of non-review writing. I think my reviews are the things that it's like the easiest thing for me to to do, excuse me. And but those are the ones I worked really hard on those at a time when I didn't really work hard very much in my writing. I do things, I'm the kind of guy who likes to do things really off the cuff and, you know, first draft and that kind of thing. But it was a chance for me to kind of show off my knowledge of Shakespearean literature and then point out what a tragedy that WWF was at that time. And it was something that's people have continued to read and endure it for about 15 years now. So I'm actually quite proud of that. That something I wrote basically when I was a kid was has carried on a legacy like that for me, and people still enjoy it. I went back and read them. It was actually a very well written piece, I think, too.
Yeah, they hold up, and those are a couple of the first things I found of your writing back in the late 90s. So I would agree with you that that's, you know, the stuff you should be proud of and willing to share. So let's do this before we get wrapped this up. Let's do a little quick lightning round. And just, I want to talk about some of your favorites in throughout wrestling history. So I'll just throw something out there, and you just, you know, quick answer on your favorite stuff here. Favorite tag team of all time?
Demolition.
Favorite announcer of all time?
Jim Ross.
Favorite pay-per-view of all time?
Ooh. As of today, Great American Bash 89. But it changes.
That's the cool thing about wrestling, isn't it? It's like you, the answer you give today is probably never going to be the same again.
Yeah, exactly.
Favorite Canadian pay-per-view?
Favorite Canadian? Well, I was at Backlash 2004. That's the only pay-per-view I've been at. So that will be my answer.
Favorite Hart Foundation member?
Favorite who? Sorry?
Hart Foundation member. Not just the original Hart Foundation, but the larger group.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, that's like, that'd be kind of a limited question. Bret Hart. I mean, the obvious answer, but I mean, it was such a huge thing in Canada at the time that, yeah, that's got to be the answer.
If you had to pick one TV show, the catalog of one TV show to bring with you to watch for eternity, which one would you choose?
Well, I mean, it's probably going to have to be Monday Night Raw, because, I mean, you know, love it or hate it, it's got a large amount of stuff to choose from, and it's the highs were incredibly high.
If there's one wrestler of whose matches you could bring with you, whose would it be?
I guess I'd have to go for the obvious answer and say Shawn Michaels.
Let me ask you where Randy Savage would rank on your list with that.
Oh, pretty high. I mean, Randy Savage is, as far as like as favorites go, Randy Savage is probably one of my favorites of all time. As far as body of work, I mean, he got really shitty in WCW. So, I mean, he was awesome for a fairly limited period of time. But, I mean, once he went off the edge, then there was no coming back from it.
Favorite WrestleMania?
Favorite or best?
Favorite.
Okay. Favorite probably would be WrestleMania 6 because it was such a huge thing for me as a kid.
Yes.
I knew you were going to say that.
I'm telling you, it's ingrained into some from our generation, Sky. You know, it's like, it's one of those shows that, yeah, if you look at it, and I'm glad you clarified best or favorite because, yes, not the best, but easily a favorite.
Not the best, but my God, Ultimate Warrior splashing and pinning Hulk Hogan. I thought I was going to have a heart attack.
There's so much great on that night. And even the Demolition Colossal Connection match is one of my favorite matches of all time. That's one I could watch over and over.
Yep. It was such a great moment. Andre the Giant slapping the shit out of Bobby Heenan, too. It was just like, that's just, what a great wrap-up to his career, you know?
Like, yes, I agree.
Yeah.
Favorite SummerSlam?
Favorite SummerSlam? I don't have too many strong memories about SummerSlam. I'll go with 92, because, again, that was the first pay-per-view I ever heard.
Favorite online writer, wrestling-based, besides yourself?
Oh, okay, I can't say myself.
Number
we
two
can say you, but you can't say you.
Well, I mean, you know, obviously Dave Meltzer. I don't know if he counts as an online writer or not, but I've always been a fan of R.D. Reynolds at WrestleCrap. Well, too. We've had a really good relationship over the years, and he's a great guy, too. So we'll go RD.
Yeah, it's good to see them back up and running again.
Mm. Yep.
And favorite incarnation of the Four Horsemen?
Oh, by far the classic Tully Arn Flair and Lex Luger one, I would say. Because I was like, I guess it's a nostalgia thing, too. I mean, they were the ones when I first started becoming a serious fan back in the 80s. That's where we were watching on, you know, Worldwide Wrestling like that, but you know, that was the graphic one. You know, Luger was another guy coming up, and I was a fan of his for life because I was, you know, it's like, hey, I watched this guy when he started out, and you know, and he went on to become a big star. So yeah, we'll go with that one.
Who's the one guy, if you could go back and change the push they received, to kind of rewrite history a little bit? Who would you pick? One guy you thought should have made it, but just didn't for whatever reason.
Yeah, I think probably I would say Luger actually. He should have been as big as Hogan was, and you know he was the wrong guy in the wrong place on a few occasions. Like when he was at his hottest, they just really wanted to push Sting. You know, and it's, if he had beaten Flair in 90, when Sting was out with the knee injury, that probably would have made Luger as a huge star, but that, you know, it wasn't the direction that they wanted to go in. And it's just one too many chokes for Luger. And, you know, it killed his passion for the business, I think, and it killed people's passion for wanting to see him be the best in the business, and, you know, just kind of fizzled out on both sides. And I think if he had beaten Flair and you know, as an inspiration for his buddy Sting being put out of action by the Horsemen, then he would have been huge and things might have been a lot different.
Favorite manager?
Bobby Heenan, of course.
And if you had to pick one guy to be in a tag team with, Mongo or Kevin Green?
Oh, jeez.
That's terrible.
Oh, come on. Mongo is the man.
That's a terrible choice. But,
Oh, boy. All right, Scott. I want to thank you so much for spending so much time with us here tonight talking wrestling. Why don't you plug some stuff? What do you got going on besides the blog and some of your reviews?
Well, actually, yeah, it's my, as usual, I have rspwfact.com for Scott's Blog of Doom. I got insidepulse.com. My reviews are posted there as well every week if you'd like to read them there. I got my Kindle books out now. You can search on Amazon for Scott's Blog of Doom, and I got a few of them on there covering topics like complete WWE in 2003, complete Saturday Night's Main Events, the complete WrestleManias. I got a few other ideas coming up as well. I think I'm going to put out soon. Most recent one I put out was the complete Coliseum video ramps, which ended up being a very popular topic as well. For a lot of people who are nostalgic for them, like I was, and yeah, it's those are my main haunts, I think, and of course, everybody should of course check out Place to Be Nation as well. The podcasts have got me through many a night shift here, actually. So thanks for that, guys.
Well, thank you for listening again. Thank you for all the plugs you gave us as well. We really appreciate it. The one and only the great Scott Keith. And Scott, tell us again, how sad were you when our Boston Bruins smacked around your Vancouver Canucks in the Stanley Cup Finals a couple of years ago?
Almost as sad as you guys were when they choked in the last minute against the Blackhawks.
Come on.
Boo.
All right, Place to Be Nation, that is the one and only the great Scott Keith again, rspwfaq.com. Check him out. Check him once. Check him often. Great guy. Really cool. And Scott, we'll love to have you back on sometime just again just talk more old school wrestling. How about that?
Absolutely. Anytime you want.
All right. Old man Scott, why don't we take a break and we'll come back and wrap up.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What I'd like to have right now.
Chad, do you ever feel that the world revolves around WWF?
I think you mean WWE there, Barf.
Yeah, whatever. But what about David Crockett?
Well, what about Jimmy Valiant?
I'm gonna get y'all until I get you, Paul Jones. Oh.
The Four Horsemen.
We are a family, and we are the best.
The Omni, the Dangerous Alliance.
Please welcome the newest members of the Dangerous Alliance, Arn Anderson and Larry Zbysko.
Jim Cornette and the Midnight Express.
The Fantastics are putting the U.S. Tag Team title on the line against the Midnight Express.
Main events with actual work rate in them.
Woo! 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 All right!
It's just not fair to Flair.
It's not fair for Flair.
If this is what you're looking for, please check out Where the Big Boys Play podcast, the only pure NWA and WCW supercard podcast out there.
While you were in Hollywood making movies, Thunder Lips, I was winning world titles.
Well, there they are, our good friends Chad and Parr, Where the Big Boys Play. Now, if you want nonstop old-school NWA discussion, dating back to that very first Starrcade, these guys have it covered. Even the PICs have made an appearance once. We are very particular what podcasts we visit. So check out our friends Chad and Parr, Where the Big Boys Play. Their link is right on our site, placetobenation.com. Just go into the podcast menu. And there they are, the other great shows we partner with. Chad and Parr, working Where the Big Boys Play. Speaking of Place to Be Nation, that's your everyday home for your pop culture needs. At placetobenation.com, we have everything. Wrestling, sports, comics, even polls. We want your opinions as well. Every day, there's something different with our top staff of writers who are experts in all fields of pop culture. From the weekly Raw review to the return of the hack, you've got everything you need. We're also working with a myriad of great podcasts, of course, besides Chad and Parr. We have Grapple Talk, the Fans Podcast, Off the Top Rope, answering the 10 count, we found new music, and the Kings of Sport with Nate Milton. We've got everything for your listening pleasure. So check us out every day of the week at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Now, don't forget about our good friend Graham Cawthon and the history of WWE.com. He's still the top source for all argument solvers, from match results to house show cards to pay-per-view histories. Any questions you need answered, any debates among wrestling fans that need ending, head over to Graham's treasure trove of information. You will certainly find it. Need to know what the opener of Starrcade 1995 was? What was the main event of that 1988 Boston Garden house show you went to when you were 11 years old? Graham can tell you. He has WWE, WCW, ECW results, and the growing results in TNA and Ring of Honor. So for all your wrestling research needs, check out Graham Cawthon at thehistoryofwwe.com. Now finally, if you want a place to just hang out, discuss all things wrestling with fellow diehard fans, check out the news and the great forums at twfnews.com. They have all the up-to-the-minute stories in WWE, TNA, and pretty much everywhere in between. They talk old school, Attitude Era, and even those hard-to-remember guys and shows like Waylon Mercy or In Your House Number 3. So check out all there is to see right on twfnews.com.
This is J.J. Dillon, the leader of the Four Horsemen, and you're listening to Place to Be Podcast.
All right, Scott, we are back. That was a lot of fun chatting with Scott Keith, something we can check off the old podcast bucket list.
Yeah, I never thought the day would come, but he was fantastic.
Yeah, really good. So. A great memory. And, you know, that's something I've been wanting to do for a while with our guests is just sit back and, hey, you know, remember this angle? Or, hey, what's your favorite memory of this show? And it was cool to do that with him. Obviously, a vault-like memory when it comes to pro wrestling, so...
I'm guessing that he's not going to buy the Triple H Thy Kingdom Come DVD. Maybe we should give it to him as a gift for being on the show.
Yeah, maybe you should send it to him and make him review it. How about that?
Oh, yeah, that'll be great.
All right, so let's talk about the upcoming weeks here. Again, we're working on getting Kevin Kelly scheduled to do the first half of 2000. Hopefully we'll get on that soon. Next week, Monday night, the one and only Mr. Kyle Forchetti. Been a while since Kyle's been with us.
Yeah, it really has. Well, we're getting close to week one, only a few weeks away.
Yeah, so we will be doing the full NFL preview. In the meantime, you can get by on placetobenation.com. You can check it out there. And then also Monday night, in addition to the NFL preview, will be the finals BTB Trivia Tournament for 2013. Mr. Mike Poulin, Mr. Ryan Everett. So be sure to check in for that. Wednesday night, we turn back the time machine once again, Scott. CRZ, Christopher Robin Zimmerman in the house.
Wow.
Pretty crazy having him and Scott Keith back-to-back. I'm looking forward to CRZ. Obviously, he's also running for mayor out in Minnesota, so following the steps of Jesse Ventura. So we'll be talking about that. I'm sure we'll talk about his career as a writer in wrestling and kind of his travel. A little bit different than Scott, because he's someone that, I don't know if he ever fell out of watching, but he definitely fell out of writing about it. Someone that went hardcore for a while and burnt out and stopped. And, he still tweets about it, still watches it. But it'll be interesting to talk to CRZ. He's really a guy that... really gotten into reading this stuff, so I'm looking forward to that. Now, the week after that is, of course, Labor Day. So as of now, we're only planning on having one show. That'll be Wednesday with SummerSlam 2000. It will kick off our NFL weekly predictions as well. And if we can talk to Kevin before then, maybe we'll squeeze that in that week as well. But there'll be no new show as of this time on Labor Day week. I'll be out of town for a little bit. You got stuff going on. So we'll do our usual Wednesday that week. So that gets into the next couple weeks here. Please, once again, if you're tuning in for the first time or if you've been fans for a long time, PlaceToBeNation.com. We can use your support. A lot of cool stuff. And just spread the word, too. If you're a fan of the site, share it with some of your friends on social media and just try and get the word out. We're really trying to build that audience up, and we rely on you and your support to do so. Even if it's as simple as streaming this podcast through there, it's great, too. Tons of podcasts on there. So a lot of cool stuff. And you heard, Scott Keith endorsed it, too. So what more of an endorsement do you need than the man himself? So
exactly.
All right, Scott, why don't we wrap up? We'll be back Monday with Kyle Forchetti in the NFL. Until then, that's Scott. I'm Justin. And thanks again to Scott Keith. We'll talk to you next week. Have a good weekend. We in the city where the pros shake, rattle, and roll. And I'm a goddamn rolling stone. I don't beg, I can hold my own. I don't break, I can hold the throne. In this way, in a turn, and I'm a son of a gun. My code name is the only one. And Black Gold is bad. These streets, he done ran. Ever since when the game began, I never played a fool. Matter of fact, I've been keeping it cool. Since money been changing hands, and I'm ready to shine. The legacy I leave behind, be the seed that'll keep the flame. I don't ask for much, but a
enough room to spread these wings, and the world finna know my name.
I don't beg from no rich man, and I don't scream and kick when his shit don't fall in my hands, man, 'cause I know how to steal. But a thousand motherfuckers, yes, my lover's will.
I would name her.